Welcome to Red Ice Radio, new or regular listeners. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. I'm glad that you stopped by redicecreations.com and decided to join us as we explore some of the most fascinating and important areas of research. We are coming to you from Gothenburg, Sweden, up in Scandinavia, but you can, of course, follow us worldwide over the internet through our website. And if you're new to the program, please take a look in our radio and webcast archive. We have over 1 year of radio available for free for you there. We have interviews with interesting people doing important research into many different subject matters. Nothing is off limits, as we are prepared to go anywhere as we search for answers. You can help spreading the word about the radio program. You can also sign up for a membership to our website and get full access to our radio archive going back to 2006. We have webcasts, films, video interviews, and much more available for you there as well. It's well worth it, and all information on how you can join is available on the website redicecreations.com. Okay, about a month ago, we had Alfred Weber with us from Exopolitics, and we talked, discussed about many different things. We touched upon the area of life on Mars, human activity on Mars, and about structures, monuments, and signs of intelligent life on Mars. And one of the people that Alfred mentioned during this program was Andrew B. Basciago and his book, The Discovery of Life on Mars. And we have Andrew with us on the line today to talk more about this and to go into more detail than we have time for with Alfred last time. And Andrew is from the Mars Anomaly Research Society. And I just want to read you an excerpt from the book here to set the context. The author presents his initial data related to his discovery of life on Mars in PIA 10214. In five areas, namely evidence of humanoid beings, animal species, carved statues, built structures, and dead bodies. The life on Mars consists of intelligent bipedal hominoids capable of carving statues and building structures, and a variety of animal species that exist, that once existed or that have never existed on Earth. Reptilian species predominate. He also addresses frightening content and definitional constraints that individuals in Mars anomaly research confront when evaluating this first view by human civilization of life forms and ancient artifacts on another planet. He concludes that the discovery of life on Mars marks an epochal monument in human history when we, for the first time, human beings from Earth have encountered biological organisms living elsewhere in the cosmos. So that should set the context for you for what we'll be going into in more detail here today. The website you can take a look at is exopolitics.com for much more. Andrew also has a Facebook group called The Discovery of Life on Mars. You can do a search for that on Facebook. So with that, welcome to the program, Andrew. Thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me on your show, Henrik. It's good to be on with you today.
Why don't you give us a little bit of a background on yourself, Andrew, and how you got involved into this subject of Mars and how your interest in this began?
Well, I'm a trial lawyer here in Washington State in the United States, and I grew up in suburban northern New Jersey and in Southern California. I'm 47. As a school child, while growing up in New Jersey, I was brought into a classified defense-related research project undertaken under the aegis of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, also known as DARPA. Those were the people who brought us the Internet. And in the late 1960s and early 1970s, DARPA had secretly launched a time-space research and development program. Somebody who went on to considerable public stature in the defense community in the United States, Donald Rumsfeld, served as the defense attaché for the project. My late father, Raymond F. Basciago, was an engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company, and like several other engineers at Parsons, was one of the engineers assigned to the project. Project Pegasus, as it was called, was really working on two areas of classified scientific development that even to this day, 40 years later, remain basically classified as official state secrets. The first was a teleportation technology that was derived from the papers of Nikola Tesla that were seized by the War Department upon Tesla's death in 1943, and they were forwarded to the world's leading physicists that were then gathering in Los Alamos, New Mexico, to build the atomic bomb. That project had the Los Alamos physics community had been developing Tesla's schematics and formulae of different devices into prototypes for 25 years before, around 1967-68, they determined that one of the devices was a teleporter. So I was brought into the project as a child participant when they were testing teleportation on civilians. The other major part of Project Pegasus derived from another device that was discovered essentially accidentally by two Vatican scientists named Ernetti and Gemelli, who, while studying Gregorian chants in the 1940s, were working on a specialized microphone where they accidentally discovered a way to capture and amplify the signal from a past event and portray it as an image on a screen. And so, working with the distinguished Italian physicist Enrico Fermi, by 1952, they had a sort of a TV screen, that is to say, a two-dimensional moving image of past events. By the time I was brought into Project Pegasus in the late 60s or early 1970s as one of the child participants, Chronovision, as it was called, which was basically relied on holograms propagated by these devices called chronovisors, it was already able to model past and future events in a three-dimensional space, that is, as a hologram that you could either look at and try to understand what was going on inside the hologram, or if you stood on the stage of the chronovisor when the hologram was propagated, you could experience being in that past or future place in terms of a virtual reality, in terms of being able to see what was going on there and actually be seen by the people of that time and place. But in fact, you were back at the laboratory and experiencing time travel in a sort of holographic way rather than directly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I first teleported, at least the time that I can remember, was, we know it was in 1967-68. Because my dad took me up to the old Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Facility, which was a defense contractor location, in Wood Ridge, New Jersey, which was about 15 minutes from our house by car. And we went into Building 68 there, and there on the shop floor was two parentheses-shaped objects. They were about 8 feet tall, about 10 feet apart on the ground, and they generated a field of energy that sort of looked like water falling in a water sculpture in a public park. That is, from 10 feet or so they did. But then if you went up to about a foot, what you saw is the energy field looked sort of like raster on a TV set. And you could see these little squiggles of blue-green light emanating across the energy field. And what my dad explained is that with the device on, he had the technician turn the device on, is that when we jumped through that field of energy, we would experience a few seconds of going through an illuminated tunnel. This was actually what they were called, vortal tunnels, not wormholes. But what they were doing was opening up sort of interstitial chasms in the fabric of time-space. We weren't being digitized and reassembled at the destination, because that would kill a human being. Because, of course, that would stop, you know, cellular metabolism.
Right, right.
They were doing the opposite. They had found a way to basically open up that extremely dense field of space that modern physics is calling the quantum plenum, so that somebody could basically stop being in one location and start being in another location. And the particular destination that they were using in those early days of time-space exploration by the U.S. government was the state capitol complex in Santa Fe, New Mexico. They selected Santa Fe not only because it's a very friendly town, but also because it's a very old town. I mean, New Mexico was settled about 400 years ago. And they were always concerned about the possibility that one of the chrononauts in the program would become lost in time. So they selected Santa Fe because it was old, because it was near many of the atomic physics research locations like Los Alamos and Albuquerque and so forth, but was not one of those places, because in fact they were concealing this technology even from the mainstream physics community at those locations, for example at Los Alamos. And if you think of Santa Fe, New Mexico, you realize, especially around the state capitol complex, it's essentially a jumble of buildings where if, let's say, a child suddenly pops into view, everybody's going to presume that they just ran around the building and there was, you know, some child lost on a school field trip or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a very small town, so that, you know, during the early days of Project Pegasus, they really couldn't, with great fidelity, determine where we were going to pop into view. They knew it was, hopefully, it was going to be in the year that we had left on the East Coast, but they were using Santa Fe because it was a small, walkable city. So that if, for example, we were put down a half mile from where they intended, we could find the collection area there at the state capitol complex and then continue on our project activities there in New Mexico. The particular hallmark or landmark that they were using, that we were trained to find and wait at after we basically popped into view, or sort of the tunnel that had been opened up closed and we were suddenly found ourselves on our feet again and, you know, 2,000 miles from where we'd just been, was the Bataan Memorial Building, which was the pre-1966 state capitol building in Santa Fe. So my first experience doing that was as a six-year-old, because we went up to, my father and I, you know, quantum leaped to Santa Fe from Woodbridge, New Jersey. And he got a car there at the state capitol complex, and we drove up to a meeting with Dr. Harold M. Agnew. And at that time, Agnew was the director of the W Division, which is the weapons division at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Mm-hmm. In 1970, he would go on and become the director of that lab. And that's really sort of the hidden history of U.S. time travel technology research, is that as a result of the Defense Department getting hold of Tesla's papers, time travel was weaponized. And it's been, his papers have been at LANL ever since then. I believe as a lawyer and as somebody who was involved in the early days of time-space research by the U.S. government, that this particular technology of teleportation needs to be liberated from America's defense labs, because we may need it as a vital technology to confront the crisis of environment and development that we now find ourselves in, primarily as a result of our burgeoning population around the world. You know, if teleportation had been not been sequestered as a weapon by the U.S. military-industrial complex, and we had used it, certainly for transportation across long distances, you know, imagine going to the Grand Central Teleport in New York City and jumping through one of these devices and popping out at Union Teleport in Los Angeles in a couple seconds. That technical capability was actually available to humanity around 1970, but to this day, it remains basically sequestered in the U.S. Defense Department, and I think that's wrong. And so I am now speaking out so that my fellow human beings know that this technology isn't some future goal that we have that we might achieve. It was reduced to practice over 40 years ago. And so I was brought in during the phase when they were testing essentially whether children could withstand this experience, and also what the medical effects and the cognitive effects would be. So when we began regularly teleporting between New Jersey and New Mexico as a group of school children, you know, as 7 and 8 year olds, in the fall of 1969, actually shortly after the lunar landing, a couple months later there in fall of 69, we would gather there in the state capitol complex and then be brought up to an old school site in Lamy, New Mexico, where we'd be medically examined by a nurse and take part in several hours of cognitive testing. So I was a time-space pioneer, but also in one sense sort of an experimentee. They were seeing you know, how teleportation would affect us. They were also eager to use us as participant observers in the remote viewing exercises involving the chronovisors.
Hmm.
For one thing, we were necessary participants, because the holograms were so sensitive that when they turned the device on with an adult on the stage, often the hologram would sort of begin fluctuating like an early TV picture and then sort of blink out. So they needed small, cooperative, and intelligent children that they could train to do the remote viewing, basically the virtual time travel and the chronovisors. And I was, you know, selected for that purpose as well. They also found that children were very astute observers. Children see things that are actually there because they don't have the prejudice of their intervening presumptions about reality and their intervening belief systems. So they were relying on us as bright, specially trained children. We were given specialized training in observation and communication and other areas so that when we went on these virtual time travel trips, we could report back accurately what we had seen and done. And then also it was clear that we were trainees because we were told that in the future, the very project that we were in involving teleportation and chronovision would evolve into a fully fledged time-space research program under DARPA that would rival the space program under NASA as a major research and development project of the United States. So it was very exciting and awe-inspiring at times, but it was also very terrifying. I mean, we took part essentially in both physical time travel experiences via teleportation mostly to the past, but several times to the future, and a substantial amount of these probes in the chronovisors, some of which I might add were so dangerous and experimental that we actually wore crystal helmets and specialized clothing to protect us from the heat and the radiation of the devices.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm also speaking out essentially as a whistleblower, you know, regarding the civil rights dimension of that, you know, American school children were used in classified testing in this way, but we were not compensated monetarily. We were not even medically monitored, much less medically insured by the U.S. military. And I believe that was wrong and unethical. And so I'm also speaking out about Project Pegasus so that we can seek redress for the participants, but more importantly, so that the people of the world know that at the very time that we entered the threshold of space exploration, we also entered the threshold of time-space exploration, and that was the significance of Project Pegasus. Project Pegasus, indeed, was the real Philadelphia experiment for which all of the sort of synthetic treatments of that subject in the mass media were actually scripted. So I'm making a specific allegation here, and that is that my research over the last 10 years into not only what I and others did on DARPA's Project Pegasus, but also more broadly defined on the subject of the development of time travel technology, convinces me that the Philadelphia experiment was not only impossible because the ship was made of metal, and metal is magnetic and can't teleport, but also was in fact a cover story that the Office of Naval Intelligence scripted to conceal what was achieved following the discovery of the capabilities of some of Tesla's devices in that time frame of 1967.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that there's I've been researching my experiences in Project Pegasus for about 10 years. Now there's an overlay with the discovery of life on Mars, because around the time that I was brought into Project Pegasus, the project itself had already identified me as a child who was destined to grow up and be principally associated with the public's understanding that Mars is in fact an inhabited planet. And so there's a whole set of essentially briefings and experiences I had in the 40 years between when I first started to participate in Project Pegasus as a 6 or 7 year old in 1967-68 and the year that I published my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, in 2008, where essentially the government was providing me information so it would sort of keep me on track about the fact that I was going to be principally associated with the revelation to the public that Mars is inhabited. So that's sort of a whole other story, but it does overlap Pegasus because I've never been able to find out precisely why I was brought into the program.
Okay.
I was testing very high in terms of both IQ and psychic ability, but I would not be surprised if I ultimately find out that the reason that I was brought into Project Pegasus was because I was a person of interest resulting from my later Mars discoveries. And they were doing that. They were identifying particular people who they knew based on their quantum access capabilities, for example, sending CIA personnel forward in time to gather data or artifacts from the future and bring it back. They were identifying individuals of my generation, of, you know, Barack Obama's generation, as future world leaders, and they were essentially doing things in our youth and later to sort of cultivate our destinies. They're not responsible for my achievements, but they knew about them, and the U.S. intelligence community did take measures to make sure that my destiny would be fulfilled. So that's another dimension of this that the public has never really been, you know, has been kept ignorant about, is the fact that time travel technology was not only derived or, you know, reduced to practice 40 years ago, based on the work of Tesla, based on Enrico Fermi's involvement actually in both of those technologies. Fermi had been sought out by Ernetti and Jumelli and worked on them with the chronovisor, and Enrico Fermi was also the mentor of Dr. Harold Agnew at the University of Chicago when the atomic bomb was being developed. So I'm also speaking out because something is influencing our politics, and that is the fact that a faction within the U.S. intelligence community has been in possession of a quantum access capability for over 40 years. And I know to a personal certainty that they have been handling particular individuals in light of a prior understanding, in light of previous findings of what their destinies are. And in fact, that is even influencing the way in which the people of the United States select their president, because I know to a personal certainty, having met three of them and having heard of one of them when I was in the project, that the four last American presidents were given prior knowledge of their presidencies based on the quantum access capabilities of the U.S. intelligence community. And since I believe in upholding the Constitution, I'm obligated to do, I'm actually sworn to do so as an attorney in the state of Washington, to uphold the U.S. Constitution just as the president does, I'm speaking out as an officer of the court and essentially as a constitutional officer, informing the people of the United States and also the people of the world that the permanent secret government of the United States is in possession of such a capability, and it is influencing presidential politics to the extent that the future presidents are being approached and informed of their destinies, and in all likelihood, receiving specialized training for the presidency. And that's a subversion of the U.S. Constitution, and that's another thing that's motivating me to speak out about the fact that the United States government is in possession of quantum access.
Yes. Well, I mean, I have obviously a ton of questions here for you. Maybe we can just talk a little bit about if you remember all of the experiments that you went through, and if you, like, generally about your life during that time, did you go to school regularly, and did you talk about this, or were you in some way gagged or prevented to speak at the time about this stuff?
Well, I had a remarkably happy and even adventuresome childhood just in my ordinary life. I was the youngest of five children, and I was going to a very good public elementary school in a very wonderful town. I think I was a lucky kid. But really, there, beginning around age six or seven, my father, who had been a participant on several advanced aerospace projects, for example, he was one of the principal engineers who had designed the ramjet engine at Curtis Wright. In fact, after the July 1952 overflight of Washington, D.C., by nine UFOs tracked at traveling at 7,000 miles per hour by Langley Air Force Base,
yes,
my dad had been working for the Okanite Company in Paramus, New Jersey, and an Army officer appeared beside his desk, as he later explained it, at Okanite, and handed him orders to report, you know, from orders from the Defense Department, to report to Curtis Wright, where he worked on the ramjet engine, which was such a classified project at that time that he was even eating, you couldn't even eat lunch with guys with different colored badges. You know, it was a compartmentalized project.
Right, right.
Its purpose was to create a supersonic plane that could chase the UFOs out of our atmosphere and near space environment. So my dad had been on that project. He'd also been on the B-70, which was the atomic equipped strategic bomber project, he was preparing other technical reports for military and intelligence agencies. So even though I must give thanks for the fact that I had a very happy and secure childhood in a wonderful family and a wonderful neighborhood at a wonderful time in American history, almost a bucolic kind of childhood. We were fishing in the summer and playing hockey, you know, ice hockey in local ponds in the winter. my dad did bring me within the cult of intelligence as a very small child. He began taking me to the defense contractor locations where he worked. And in fact, my first acclimation trip for Project Pegasus was in the summer vacation after kindergarten. He took me to the General Manufacturing Company facility in Convent Station, New Jersey, where the chronovisor originally would be located, that we wouldn't encounter until the fall of 1970. So here, 4 or 5 years in advance, when I'm 5, 6 years old, he was already preparing me for some of these defense contractor locations that I wouldn't see for 3 or 4 years. Now, at school, we were enrolled in a learning lab that was essentially a sequestered learning environment that was cut off from the rest of the school. They took one of the art labs, and they set up a special program for gifted and talented students in that part of the school that we were attending on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. So they had us starting off the week in the learning lab and spending about 60% of our schooling there during third, fourth, and fifth grade. This would have been beginning in the fall of 1969 and lasting until the end of my fifth grade year in summer of 1972. And so we would show up there and spend 3 days out of five in that context, and then we'd have, you know, Fridays we would be back with our peers in our normal classroom to kind of readjust before going home, you know, to our house and, you know, our family and neighborhood for the weekends and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So they were really grooming us at a young age. We were given both sort of positive and negative reinforcement to not talk about our experiences. Right there in the learning lab, however, they began to involve us in extremely unusual activities, some of it academic, but some of it really on the outer envelope of parapsychology testing and training. Initially, they started us with this advanced academic program called Galileo, which covered all of the advances in science and the important historical events from the year 1450, which would be the time of the High Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trained how to read things almost instantaneously. And we were receiving specialized education on these devices called tachistoscopes, which were speed learning machines that had been developed by the Office of Naval Research and that had been manufactured at one of my late father's former employers, which was the Thomas A. Edison Research Labs in West Orange, New Jersey. And through that means, we would stand at a device and essentially receive sort of this college liberal arts education. You know, I think we must have gotten a BA in the history of science and world civilization for those 3 years. In fact, that speed learning was so saturating that there were U.S. Army field hospital cots in the learning lab. And so we would spend several hours in the speed learning with the stuff whizzing past us.
Huh.
And then we would actually sometimes collapse and fall asleep on the cots. So they were essentially giving us all of the information they thought we should have in our heads when we were time traveling. We would have an understanding, let's say like a BA in electrical engineering would have from college, of basic historical developments in science and in society. Then as that was ongoing for those 3 years, very early on they began us in parapsychology screening and training. So one of the things they started off with was the teacher would look at a standard playing card and put it to her forehead and concentrate on it, and we would have to guess the playing card that she was thinking of. And I was so clairvoyant during those years that we would play that game for, let's say, 2 hours, and I was getting the playing card right every time she would come to me, you know, working with 3 or 4 children. So I and a number of the other children were really testing in the far right side of the bell curve in terms of psi abilities, and that was one of the traits that they were looking for. They were looking for bright, perceptive, psychically active children, and that's what they found. Then the parapsychology training really went off into some very far out areas, even before we left the environment there of the learning lab and started being taken to defense contractor locations. For example, they were spinning us to induce out-of-body experiences. And sometimes while going out-of-body, we would reach the limit of this thing, a device that looked like it was generating the hologram that we're living in. And then we would be brought back from being out of body and questioned about what we saw. And I remember being told during those years that device that was propagating our reality they were calling the Matrix, which obviously that concept later found its way into a feature film.
Indeed.
So they were inducing OBEs, and in that sense we were involved in kind of the telepathy testing and the out-of-body experiences that were being researched at places like J.B. Rhine's Parapsychology Research Unit in North Carolina, and also the Monroe Institute of Robert Monroe.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, contemporaneous with those, with that era of psychic exploration. I think it was undoubtedly related to that, because that was something that the U.S. intelligence community was very actively investigating that during those years. Now, in terms of time travel per se, we had our first time travel experiences in the learning lab, not only performing conventional remote viewing for the military. We would have these exercises where a team leader and a U.S. naval officer would come to the learning lab and set up some sort of practical exercise where we would be asked to remotely view something, some sort of military target or priority. But they also brought a device into the learning lab called the Montauk Chair.
Oh.
And this is another device that has been rumored to be have been developed by Nikola Tesla. I'm not sure that that's the case, but some researchers allege that it's another Tesla device.
Yes.
It basically looks like a dental chair, and you sit in it, and there's a tube of some kind at your feet that comes up and is pointed at your head, and there's a sort of a photographer's umbrella above your head, and there's a solenoid on the back of the chair right behind your solar plexus. And I remember there was something called a CPU, which I never understood what that meant. There was a computer processing unit under the chair. And you would sit in this chair, and you would wear a mask with some light diodes placed on top of the cotton mask over your eyes and a headset on your ears. And this chair would generate this strange, syncopated, almost musically or mathematically beautiful set of sound tones, and you'd have a dissociative experience where you'd hover out of your body and feel yourself rushing forward in time, feet first, actually, almost like a toboggan or a schluch rider, and you'd see something forming on the horizon, and then you'd hit it. You'd suddenly smack into it, and you would find yourself in a subjective moment in your own personal future. It was literally like, it was basically an induced astral projection. Hmm. And then we would suddenly find ourselves back in the chair, very exhausted, I remember, and somebody would question us about what we were doing and seeing. For example, if we found ourselves, you know, 40 years in the future watching television, they would say things like, well, do you remember what was on the television set? Oh, the president was addressing the American people. What was his name? Hmm. Et cetera.
Yeah.
So that was a way of gathering information about the future, by astrally projecting the time traveler to that location. And I think it's pretty much consistent with the account of time travel that has appeared in the Montauk Project book series of Preston Nichols and Peter Moon. The chair we know was developed or at least tested at the Montauk Naval Air Station in Long Island. And we know from Dr. David Anderson that in 1970, the very time that's consistent with my account of what I experienced, the Montauk chair sort of went national, and they involved thousands of American school children in these probes to their own futures as a way of gathering intelligence about future events. And so I would caption that technology under the rubric of psychic time travel. It was basically an induced astral projection. And we did that the whole time we were in the project. And curiously, ever since then, I've had episodes of deja vu where I find myself in the location in my life, you know, the time and place that they had preternaturally sent me to as an 8 and 9 year old back in New Jersey when I was enrolled in Project Pegasus. But Project Pegasus wasn't just a parapsychology lab, and it wasn't just an advanced research project involving gifted and talented American school children. Because some of us went on, those of us who were performing very high in intellectual performance, in perception and memory, you know, in our ability to see something and report back accurately what we had seen, who were performing at a high level in terms of our psychic ability, we found ourselves going on to even more unusual experiences at defense labs around the country. And those pretty much centered around the teleporter and chronovisor devices that I've described. We were essentially teleporting back and forth between New Jersey and New Mexico. And then after teleporting to New Mexico, they were keeping us there, involving us in time travel to past and future places, teleporting us back to New Mexico, and then back to New Jersey on the afternoon of the mornings we had left New Jersey. So part of the sort of the anthropology or the archaeological project I found myself on going back and excavating my memories of Project Pegasus is that I had to sort of deconstruct these timelines of what actually they had involved us in. And I was able to map everything in terms of the time and the place and the devices and the people and the events. And what I've been able to reconstruct, I think quite accurately, and I think my book will show this, is that in those 3 years, we were sent to 4 summers in New Mexico. So in the summer of 1970, they began us teleporting back and forth and introducing us to the phenomenon of quantum displacement, where you teleport somewhere and then stay there and do things and then teleport back to, let's say, an hour after you left your point of embarkation. So that time loop sort of collapses. There's no evidence of it because you're back on your linear A timeline that you left. And then in 1971, I spent a long summer there. And then in fall of 1971, my father and I jumped to the beginning of the summer of 1973 in New Mexico and had a set of project experiences there. I was even able to find the rental house that we rented in White Rock, New Mexico, which is a small town near Los Alamos. And I've been able to map hundreds of data points of things we encountered when I was on the project in New Mexico. And then finally, after having experienced the summer of 1973, before it occurred really to ourselves or others in our lives, we went back to New Jersey in the fall of 71. I completed the fifth grade. And in the summer of 72, my father and I spent our 4th summer in New Mexico in the summer of 72. And I must say that when I say summer of 71 and 72 in New Mexico, I have to speak of them as the first summer of 1971 or the first summer of 1972. Mm-hmm. Because when we doubled back to New Jersey via teleportation after spending several months in New Mexico during those summers, we lived our whole lives over again and in a different way on our original timeline. So those summers began again as my school year ended and different things happened. I remember telling my brothers one time when we were camping in Maine in the summer of 1972, shortly before we moved to New Jersey as a family, that we were coming back from the showers back to our campsite and at Rangeley Lakes, Maine. And I said, this is the second summer of 1972 that I'm living. And they thought that was so hilarious that they actually pushed me off the trail. So in answer to your question, I've kind of gone long with my answer, but I was having a normal childhood, but I was being sequestered in the specialized learning environment.
Yeah.
And then by the summer of 1970, after we had spent that third grade year in the learning lab, they then began to involve us in teleporting to New Mexico. And my life became very complicated from that point forward. But really, these were sort of excursions from my ordinary childhood. I didn't grow up thinking that I had had a difficult or extremely complicated childhood. It was essentially a set of wondrous and also very terrifying experiences. Because I had obligations. I mean, I was being treated, in the sequelae in my childhood, in the learning lab, in the defense contractor locations I was taken to where I was given specialized training, in the time travel itself, we were being treated like little soldiers, as if we had adult duties to the American people and to the government. And so it wasn't something we could opt out of. We had to basically buck up and time travel. And so I didn't have an ordinary childhood, but my childhood was left intact enough so that as I matured, I had very good feelings about my childhood because I had wonderful parents, exceptional siblings, and I was living in a great town in a great era of U.S. history. And so it wasn't really until my mid-30s when I experienced a little bit of an impediment in my career direction or in terms of moving forward in my career that I was able to go back and revisit what had happened to me 30 years previously and get a grasp of how exceptional it was and what an obligation I had to tell the truth of what I had experienced.
Yeah.
But it was a great adventure, and I think as the book will show, it was really high adventure. My father stated shortly before his death in 1990, he asked me to tell the story of what we did in Project Pegasus because, as he said, we were in something great. I mean, it was really a phenomenal adventure, and it was an important emergent period in terms of human functioning in the universe. I remember we met the scientist William Shockley toward the end of the experience, as he was at that time the principal technical advisor to the U.S. Army. And I remember him, Dr. Shockley, saying something actually very brilliant, which was he thanked us for helping the U.S. government prove that time travel was possible, but he also explained that the reason that they had decided to explore time-space is because when they explored space, all they were going to get was what was going on at that time at that location in the universe. But by exploring time-space, they were potentially going to be able to explore everything that had ever gone on anywhere in the universe.
God.
So there were really some very brilliant people who had been responsible for launching Project Pegasus, and I want to emphasize that as well. It really was a great period of exploration, a great research enterprise, and I think that the field itself holds tremendous potential for humanity.
Were there any other kids involved in the program that you've stayed in contact with and that can share a similar story? Has anyone else gone out with this information, or are you the only one at this point?
Well, that's more problematic. When I was on the project, I was told that 140 children were involved, of roughly my age, a couple of years younger and older. So these would be individuals born roughly between 1959 and 63, I would say, around that age group. Probably centered around 1961, because most of the kids in the program were my contemporaries. I was born in September of 1961. I made an effort to find and interview my peers in my particular learning lab in New Jersey. There were groups of 10 that were arrayed in 14 different colors, and each of the groups was assigned a color, and there was a particular captain who had been assigned to that small, regiment of children. So I was the captain of blue team. And in other words, I had to exercise special duties if something disastrous happened when we were time traveling. In fact, there was one mishap where I actually essentially pulled rank and told the kids what we were going to do. So the 14 captains had specialized, even additional specialized training. I don't think that's the reason, by the way, that I remember what happened. There's a number of reasons why I'm one of the rememberers, but when I tried to find the other children who were assigned to Blue Team, which was a cadre of children who were going to my school and several surrounding grammar schools in northern New Jersey, I found something very interesting. I found that they remembered me. They remembered being involved in gifted and talented education in childhood. They began to remember the very strange things that we did in the learning lab, including being spun to induce out-of-body experiences, including sitting in this chair where they were having astral projections, and including getting certain specialized forms of intelligence and military training. Then I would try to get them to, I would mentally try to take them to the places where we were taken off campus. In my case, that was the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, where the teleport was. We were taken up to a chronovisor location in Convent Station that was then moved to an historical building undergoing historical renovation in Morristown, New Jersey, where General Washington had wintered in 1777 and 1781. There was also a defense contractor location where one of the big chronovisor arrays was at the ITT Defense Communications Building in Nutley, New Jersey. And I would interview each of the fellow participants in the project. Some of them even remembered that we had been shown that we were in a federal research project under what was originally ARPA, which then became DARPA.
Yes.
And that we were taken to defense locations like the Defense Communications Facility, of ITT in Nutley. But then strange things would happen in the interviews. For example, I would say, okay, well, let's follow up next Saturday. And then I would call them a week later, and they would, let's say, not remember talking to me. Or not remember, they would remember that I called the previous weekend, but then not be able to remember what we had discussed. One individual who not only was in my grammar school, but I knew he was in the project, and I'd gone to Sunday school with him as a Catholic school kid, and he lived in our neighborhood. So we literally grew up together. I remembered the fact that one time when we teleported to Santa Fe, he ran around the building and practically collided with me, the Bataan Memorial Building, which was literally the building they were trying to teleport us right next to. And during that teleportation in New Mexico, I had been addressing him as Kevin, which is his given name, and he kept on insisting that he wasn't Kevin, he was Scott. And so I knew that when I interviewed him, that when we were in the project, he was amnestic about who he actually was. And so I was interviewing him pretty gingerly, trying to avoid causing him to begin panicking or be troubled about what we had been through. But when I started to describe the teleportation experience, he started saying, "Oh yes, God, yes, I know we were doing that. Yeah, I haven't thought about that for years, Andy. I can't believe we're talking about this." And then he panicked and hung up. So my conclusion was, especially when I reconstructed several of the torture sessions that we had been involved in, the electromagnetic shocking that they were doing to us when we would return to the Curtis Wright facility after teleporting back from New Mexico, I realized I was dealing essentially with a special class of witnesses, a class of witnesses that had been both traumatized by what we'd experienced and directly brutalized by the defense department handlers who were working with us.
Yeah.
So as they took us down the rabbit hole of quantum access, they also took us down the clinical corridors of mind control.
Yes.
And so part of my story is my own effort as an individual to try to bear witness to what happened and to go back and recover what happened so that it can advantage humanity knowing it by overcoming the brainwashing that I was subjected to. The true story, in fact, of my effort, my 10-year effort to go back and find out what happened in Project Pegasus, not only as an exercise of memory, but as an exercise of direct field investigation on my part, was really a matter of overcoming the brainwashing and establishing the people, the places, the technologies, and the experiences. And at this point, I have 225 passages for my book. I still have to synthesize it into a narrative. But I've essentially gone back and spoken now to 10 government insiders. I wouldn't call them whistleblowers, but they were people who confirmed basically three things. One, that Project Pegasus existed under DARPA, that it involved time travel technology that had just been developed by the United States government when I found myself in those experiences, and that I myself indeed was one of the children attached to the project. So I'm going to be identifying who those people are and what they know and what they told me. Do I have a smoking gun piece of evidence that I was in the project and existed? No, I don't have my name on a U.S. government letterhead. But I'm going to be identifying who was involved and what they did in the project and what they know and how they know it.
And try to get them to speak out as well?
Yes, I'm going to be publicly calling for Defense Secretary Donald Henry Rumsfeld and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, one a Republican and the other a Democrat, to now come forward and reveal to the American people and the people of the world that the U.S. government developed teleportation and was using it for teleportation-based time travel beginning in around 1967-68. I mentioned that Secretary Rumsfeld, who was a person that my father and I knew and had a lot of contact with on the project and regarded as a very fine man. He was very respected in the program. He was the point man between the project engineers and federal science administrators like Dr. Agnew and the Pentagon. So he is one of the insiders who should have some of the most important memories of what Project Pegasus achieved. I'd like to do an appearance with him on 60 Minutes or in some other mainstream television news show and talk about what the project achieved. It was actually a great accomplishment of American civilization that we should be taking credit for and telling others about, not concealing as a state secret. The other prominent American politician who was involved was, as I said, Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico. He was about 25 years old, and he was the individual who was essentially doing the head count when we would teleport to Santa Fe in 1970.
Really?
He was there at the state capitol complex, and he had our names first and last. He would do a head count and then take us into the Bataan Memorial Building and sit us individually in a room, I think right around now where the Attorney General's office is in New Mexico, there in that building. And there'd be a simple chair with a desk on it there, and we'd walk into the room, and Bill Richardson would sit down in his chair desk, you know, and ask us our name first and last, sometimes ask us to spell our last name. Obviously, I have a rather unusual one, so I remember doing that. Mm-hmm. One time I asked him his name, and he said, Bill, and I said, Bill what? And he said, Richardson. So I know it was a young Bill Richardson. He also was very well regarded by the project people, including my dad. In fact, it's sort of hard to describe the culture we were living in. It was one in which a loose network of engineers and scientists, people like my father and William Shockley, or my father and Enrico Fermi. We didn't meet Fermi, but we did meet Emilio Segre. So you had engineers from Parsons and other large process engineering companies. I remember there Bob Beckwith, who had just been working for GE, was one of the project scientists. And he's gone on and acknowledged the existence of, as he calls it, levitated, I believe, teleportation.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this loose assemblage of engineers from major process engineering companies, federal scientists, and defense technical personnel, representatives of the Defense Department, and even some New Mexico natives who were the friends and intimates of some of the people on the project, who would be, let's say, having lunch at the La Hacienda restaurant or the La Placida restaurant in Albuquerque and talking about the project, but talking in somewhat of a veiled way so that people at the next table wouldn't know they were talking about. So it was in that context where here we are, you know, rubbing elbows with intelligence operatives at lunch, and people like Don Rumsfeld and my father, who had reporting requirements to the CIA. In fact, during my investigation, working through an intermediary, we contacted the Central Intelligence Agency, and the answer that came back was that they couldn't share information with the family members of a living or deceased CIA personnel. So that was pretty much tantamount to acknowledging that my dad was CIA.
Hmm.
So in that context, just socializing with people from different walks of life who were actually in the project, these individuals were reading intelligence reports that synthesized information about future events. So I remember there being chit-chat around the lunch table that, you know, young Bill, you know, the young man who's working as a staffer on the project and doing the head count when the kids pop into view in Santa Fe, he becomes governor. and Ray's son's Andy, he's going to go on and be one of the first people to tell the people of the world the life forms that are on Mars. They were actually laughing about what they knew, because it was information that wouldn't. And I remember them talking about the advent of the Clinton presidency or the internet.
Mm.
And these were like fascinating, coveted secrets they had because somebody would read something in an intelligence report and then they would share what they knew. So, for example, one time we went into a bar in Albuquerque and my dad and Don Rumsfeld commiserated about actually being on a federal research project where they were involving children in time travel. And my dad said, but about 15 minutes into the discussion, my dad said to Rummy, we found out on the program that you make defense secretary. And at this point, Rumsfeld had only been a former congressman and was here on, you know, a secret defense project.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that he said, well, Ray, I saw that in one of the reports, but let me tell you, that's something I'll only believe when it happens. So they were actually in this strange world, almost this alternate reality, if you will, where they were sharing information about the future with each other. And sometimes they were getting it right, and I know sometimes they were getting it wrong. One thing I remember them having difficulty about getting their heads around was what exactly the internet was. And I remember that John McCone of the CIA was at lunch, and he was trying to explain that the device was something like sitting in front of a TV set with a keyboard, like an electric typewriter, and through a connection to a network, you could share written messages with anybody else anywhere in the world. And I remember my dad and some of the other engineers at the table really trying to imagine what the internet was and talking about it. So there were some really hysterical moments when I look back on how they got some things very right and other things they really couldn't comprehend.
Yeah.
But it was in that context that I met George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush during one of those social gatherings with the project principals. And I remember George W. Bush joking to everybody around the tables. We were at three tables in this particular restaurant in Albuquerque. He was joking that me and my daddy are going to become president. So they clearly had already been briefed. I remember Bill Clinton being discussed as a future American president. And in the late 80s, when I was questioning my dad about what he knew about my future and the future in general, this was when he was ill shortly before his death in January of 1990, I remember he said that there was going to be an African-American president of the United States, but he couldn't remember his name. He had read it many years earlier. He said it was something like Brick Obanja. So clearly Barack Obama's name appeared in the intelligence reports that Project Pegasus was gathering about future events, namely the Obama presidency. Now, by sheer serendipity, I believe possibly by some form of divine intervention, if we now move 10 years forward in time, when I was an undergraduate at UCLA, I was having a discussion with an anti-apartheid activist on Bruin Walk, which is where all the political pamphleteers hand out their literature on the UCLA campus in Westwood. And I was having a discussion with this man, and I was sharing some of my ideas about political economy, you know, what impact the transnational corporations would have on global development for good or ill. And he said, you know, I have a house guest that I'd like you to meet, so why don't you come by and visit my house in West Los Angeles, and I can introduce you to this person. So I got in his VW bug, and we went over to West Los Angeles, and I met this young, intelligent, articulate man from Columbia University who explained to me that his name was Barack Obama. And he had just transferred to Columbia after attending college in Occidental College in the Pasadena area for a couple of years. And he had done a year at Columbia, he explained, and was back in Los Angeles visiting his friends from his first 2 years of college. So this must have been spring or summer break of 1982. And I had a political discussion with Barack, and it started to become somewhat heated. It was a pretty voluble political discussion. In which I was taking a fairly socialist view of corporations, and he was taking a more doctrinaire sort of liberal democratic view of why corporations are necessary and so forth, and more of a legalistic view rather than a social justice view of the corporations. And toward the end of the conversation, we really started to argue, and his friend, the anti-apartheid activist who had invited me over to his house, said, "You better be nice to him, Andy, because he's going to be president of the United States someday." And at that time, you know, immersed in my college years, I certainly wasn't thinking about what I had done as a 10-year-old in a black, defense project, a classified research project,
okay.
Defense project. And so we were, ordinary, sarcastic, verbal undergraduates. And so I said something like, "Oh, yeah, right, maybe... Or maybe both of us will, pitch, for the teams in the World Series during the, bottom of the ninth in some World Series." And then Barack used that as an excuse to sort of break away from this argument that was fomenting between us. And his friend from South Africa said, "No, you don't understand, Andy. We know he's going to be president." So. That indicated that Barack Obama had not only been briefed on the fact that he was going to be president, but he was revealing it to principals in his political circles when we weren't even 21 years of age. So that, I think, will help explain why I'm coming forward at this time, sort of on the political level regarding Project Pegasus. We're living in a world in which individuals like Barack Obama entered the 2008 presidential election with an inherent advantage, and that advantage was that he knew he was going to win. In fact, he didn't just know it that year, he knew it 27 years previously, or 26 years previously.
Right.
And that was not a stage setup, because that meeting only resulted because I had a fairly substantial political discussion with his ally in the anti-apartheid movement. The individual was on the UCLA campus because during those years, the anti-apartheid movement was pressuring the University of California to divest from South Africa. And that's the literature he was handing out. And my scrutiny of his literature just ended up resulting in this discussion about, you know, in the realm of political economy, about what the multinationals in general were going to be doing to the human race.
Yes.
You know, environmentally, socially, economically. You know, sort of the themes that would later find their way into David Corton's book about the transnationals. You know, what's going to happen when the corporations rule the world, right?
Yes.
So it was a discussion in the nature of that. It clearly wasn't some setup by the intelligence community. So here, as somebody that they could have no reckoning, had been involved as a child during the early years of time-space exploration by the U.S. government, here they were revealing to me that Barack Obama as a 20-year-old, because we were 20 in the summer of 1982, okay? He would turn 21 in that August, and I would turn 21 in September of that year.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so here we have this personal revelation, a tacit admission, if you will. He didn't say it, but his friend said it in front of me, that Barack Obama knew he was going to be president when we were 20. So he had 27 years to mentally and spiritually prepare for those responsibilities, for that experience.
Right.
That destiny. And I just think that, you know, reality really is stranger than people can imagine it to be, because so much has been kept back from the people. And I think that that's an unfair advantage. It certainly subverts the U.S. Constitution.
Yes.
And I nonetheless didn't vote because I knew he was going to win. I still think that that doesn't mean that he's not a fine individual, and that doesn't mean he can't have a capacious impact on his times as a result of being an intellectually and spiritually capacious individual. But something is going on that is subverting the way in which people believe they're selecting their leaderships.
Yes.
In a constitutional republic that should be revealed and should in some way be controlled for. They shouldn't be briefing people about their destinies in this way. But I know, at least in the case of the Bushes and Obama, that they were told, because it came right in the case of George W. Bush from his own mouth, and in the case of Barack Obama from one of his allies, political allies, in my presence. The question of Bill Clinton is more complicated because I don't have direct information that Bill Clinton was briefed, but he was spoken of several times when I was on the project, this young man named Bill Clinton being one of our next future presidents.
Yes.
Andrew,
yeah. Sorry to cut you off here, but what I want to say here as well is that obviously, this puts a totally different spin to the reality that we know, and I think I have more questions for you right now than even before we started, but I want to begin to round things up over the first hour and then continue talking more here in our member section for the second hour. But maybe you can just mention for us a little bit here about your book. Is it available right now for purchase or on the web? How's it going with the book?
Well, my book about my experiences in Project Pegasus is a work in progress.
Yes.
And it should be done within the next year. My writings about Mars, I don't have a book out about Mars yet, although I'm going to be, but I have a 40-page paper entitled The Discovery of Life on Mars that is posted at www.exopolitics.com. And at that location on Alfred Weber's website, I have about an additional 40 monographs in the area of natural history where I'm attempting to show that Mars is an inhabited planet. The linkage to Mars from Project Pegasus is that as a result of being involved in time travel experiences in childhood, in the summer of 1981, I was approached by a CIA officer that they placed in my life beginning in around 1980. His name was Courtney M. Hunt. And his identity as a CIA official, as well as my identity as a child participant in DARPA's Project Pegasus, have been confirmed by people with an expert knowledge of U.S. intelligence history. For example, Dr. Jean Maria Arrigo has confirmed that, and also Captain Ernest Garcia have confirmed both of those data points. Hunt was essentially inveighing upon me throughout the summer of 1981 whether or not I wanted to go to Mars. And I really didn't want to go. Not so much that I was afraid of teleporting, but just the whole idea of being on another planet was so deracinatingly strange. I just didn't want to go there. You know, the idea of leaving Mother Earth and being on this red planet was just something that every time he asked me whether I would go or not, I really tried to decline and say, well, look, you know, it's just not my bag. You know, I just don't want to do that. I was also concerned, obviously, about returning.
Yes.
You know, because I love my life here on this beautiful, beautiful blue earth, green earth. But nonetheless, he said, look, you have to go. And I said, why? And he said, because the future of the human race, the survival of the human race depends on it. And when I was told that, I thought, well, I better go. So as a result of my experience at time traveling, you know, and having a lot of experience teleporting, for example, in Project Pegasus as a child, in 1981, I took several trips to Mars via a jump room located at a CIA facility in El Segundo, California. So the literature that David Wilcock is releasing, you know, that he's been focusing on.
Yes.
For example, David claims that there are 600,000 U.S. personnel on Mars today.
Mm.
I really can't discount that because I was sent up to Mars for the CIA 28 years ago via teleportation, and there were already U.S. personnel there. And so the question is, you know, why are you describing yourself as the discoverer of life on Mars? What's this focus on life forms on Mars? Well, we're really talking about two different research tracks that I'm on.
Yes.
One of them is in the realm of natural history, where, as you'll see in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, I'm trying to assess what's on the surface of Mars. Mars has an ecologically fragile but nonetheless existing biosphere. And so there's the whole issue of protecting that environment from colonization by humans from Earth, from the effects of even us visiting there. Because we're not only visiting there, we've been visiting there for decades. I was teleported to this big concrete underground room and then told to walk up some stairs up to the surface of the planet. And there was sort of an access point out to the surface resulting from this skull-like statue that they had on the surface. And I walked through the eyes of this skull and then out onto the surface. There were three humans from Earth waiting for me there on Mars. Okay, so already in 1981, there was a substantial concrete infrastructure one story below the surface of Mars. So the first track I'm on is to talk about what's on Mars. Mars is a whole new planet. That's why I asked the National Geographic Society to publish my data. We're talking about the discovery of a whole new world. In NASA photograph PIA 10214, I have found indisputable evidence of humanoid beings, animal species, very unusual carved statues, many of them made from indigenous boulders, and built structures on Mars. So just independent of my own experiences, in an area where I can prove my allegations because there's photographic evidence to support my claims derived by NASA and the European Space Agency, I'm making a case, and I think I've already made it in the public domain, that Mars is inhabited. It has an indigenous environment, one that was there before we began building secret bases there.
Yes.
The other research track I'm on, that's obviously going to be much more difficult to prove because I don't have direct evidence like photographs, is that I've been to Mars, that the U.S. government has been teleporting personnel there for decades, that there are secret bases there, that the human civilization on Mars, both the indigenous and our own, is essentially underground, although, you know, primarily underground, although the humanoids can be and have been photographed on the surface, that some of them have been incidentally captured in NASA's photographs. So the second research track I'm on is one of deep exopolitics, where I'm trying to bring attention not just to the fact that Mars is inhabited, but that Mars is a place that U.S. Chrononauts, U.S. time-space personnel have already been visiting and are essentially creating a U.S. presence on. I don't know if it's 600,000 people like David Wilcock states, but by now it certainly could be. Because when I went up there in 1981, there were already support personnel to greet me up there. So obviously, in broad heuristic terms, I'm not the discoverer of life on Mars, in the sense that there were already people up there to discover life forms there when I arrived. I'm using the phrase the discoverer of life on Mars to focus on the fact that in the works of natural history that I'm writing, I'm the first author to prove that Mars is inhabited. So, I mean, if somebody captured a Bigfoot alive, would they be the discoverer of Bigfoot, or would they be the person who proved that Bigfoot actually exists. I don't
know.
So there's some degree of definitional latitude there. But I do know that my role in being principally associated with the public revelation that Mars is an inhabited planet was identified by Project Pegasus and spoken of, and I was given evidence of these discoveries when I was a child involved in Project Pegasus.
Yes.
So in the same manner that, let's say, they identified a young Barack Obama as a future president, I know my Mars research was the publicly significant thing that had caused them to focus on me as a person of interest. In fact, give me a prior view of some of the data. So that's a whole other story. Maybe we can cover that in the second hour.
But
that's sort of the overlap. They knew I would be playing a significant role regarding the revelation of life on Mars. And I don't think it really matters whether I'm a discoverer or not. But the key thing is that in my writings is the indisputable case that even if the Defense Department of the United States was to stipulate we don't have personnel up there and never have, our rovers are showing that Mars is inhabited.
Yes.
And that's significant. That'll change our view of our place in the solar system and in the cosmos. And it should.
Absolutely. And again, Andrew here, let's dive into some of these areas here in hour two, because again, as I mentioned, I have more questions for you now than we even began. So stay with us. We'll take a short break and continue here in hour two in a little while. Hour two with Andrew Basciago is coming up for Red Eyes members, and this is something you do not want to miss. We begin to talk about DARPA, the development of the internet via ARPANET. We talk about foreknowledge of 9/11, Rumsfeld, some of the other boys, and their access to the Chronovision technology. We ask if other countries have been using the technology, and more about why Andrew is going out as an insider at this time to reveal more information about Project Pegasus. We discuss the suppression of the technology, how it can be a social destabilizing factor. We even talk about religion, and Andrew says that he actually got to see recorded images of the crucifixion of Jesus. Is this true? We ask if it's historical propaganda. We talk about the validity of Chronovision and if our history has been mapped and recorded by those who have access to the technology. This is a jam-packed hour two, and we will return with a whole new program with Andrew later to specifically discuss Mars and what he has seen in terms of the future. But do not miss this very interesting program. Go to our website, redeyescreations.com, sign up, tune in to hour two of this program for Red Eyes members. We have more radio coming up with Lloyd Pye, Ellen Brown, Nick Pelling, David Jacobs, Kevin P. Miller, and David Icke. But we'll be right back after some music.